Welcome to Season 3 of Do Better Research, a learning-focused podcast about research methods. My name is Dr. Suzanne Albury, and I'll be guiding you through research methods to become a better researcher, both for academic study and professional practice. This season, we will be looking in depth at some new research paradigms, as well as delving deeper into some previous topics. In this episode, I talk to David Carpenter, who works as a trainer for the Health Research Authority, the UK Research Integrity Office, and the Association of Research Managers and Administrators. We talk about the paradigm of virtue ethics, what it is, and what it means to researchers and participants. David comes to this episode with a wealth of knowledge and experience on what ethics means to research and how we can embed ethical practices to become better researchers. So David, thank you very much for joining me on the Do Better Research podcast. I really appreciate having you here, especially, as I said, because we've already had some training from you from my institution, my university, which was really interesting, which is why I got hold of you. And I wanted to talk to you today about ethics, specifically your approach to ethics. So would you mind telling people what your approach to ethics is?
Firstly, thank you for inviting me to join you on this podcast. It was a delight to teach you and others at Suffolk. And listeners might want to know that I've got numerous roles, but amongst them, I work as an independent consultant and I work for UKREO, that's the UK Research Integrity Office. And I basically supply their research ethics training to all universities and any other research organisations who are members. And just a little plug, they get that as a membership benefit. So they get at least one 3-hour session absolutely free of charge. When I think about ethics and me, and obviously specifically research ethics, because that's your area of interest, I think the first thing that strikes me is, if you say to any researcher, when I say to you, what does research ethics mean to you? And think about the images and the recollections in some cases that come to mind, it's not particularly good. You know, it is, I parody it a bit. Research ethics is the thing that, you have to do at the end, don't you? You know, you get your research all nicely together, you plan your protocol, you're excited, you're ready to go, you're ready to run, and then somebody says to you, ethics, you better get ethics, which means that then you have to fill in various forms and what have you, present them to an ethics committee who deliberate and eventually come back and decide in popular language whether or not your research is approved. I don't like that popular language because the ethics committee, of course, can only give an opinion on your research, an ethics opinion. So the ethics, what you're hoping is that the research ethics committee will come back with, if you conduct your research according to the paperwork that you've given us, then we believe your research to be ethical. Now, that is, I think, what comes to most people's minds. And so it becomes a hurdle that has to be overcome and they work from there. If you look at research ethics more broadly, as opposed to that experience, a lot of it is really quite historical, and it's grown up, I would say, into a massive industry. So you look at research ethics in universities, in the NHS, in various other organisations, and you know it's become really quite systematised. And ethics committees, you know, as I say, deliberate and they come back with their responses. But does anybody really ask, you know, is this research going to be conducted ethically? Okay, it's been through the committee. You know, if that was a one-off event, then how do we know that the researcher is going to behave ethically as a researcher? Haven't got a clue. And actually, most ethics committees don't even inquire to find out, yes, that's all well and good, but, you know, what are you going to do? Now, I think some of this is because it's due to the history. Of course, I'm not going to go off too much on the history. It's boring. But, you know, OK, mostly it started in Nazi Germany. Mostly it was about experiments on people. And mostly it was about trying to advance science. I think that's undeniable. But with no respect for people at all. And it was obviously an abuse of people. There's no question about that. And from there, obviously there was the Nuremberg trials. Eventually, eventually the Declaration of Helsinki, which still sits there today, which governs largely medical or biomedical type research. It comes from the World Medical Association, so that's not surprising. Now, it seems to me that most committees have stuck on to this idea of, you know, abusing people for scientific ends and so on. And in the end, I think probably focusing more on compliance than ethics. So when the researchers' paperwork goes off to the ethics committee, they dutifully look at it, see if it's followed all the templates. You know, are you using the university participant information sheet template? Have you used all the questions? How are you using the consent form? You know, and all of that sort of stuff. So it becomes a sort of a compliance check. And then probably when all else fails, they then start to go off more into areas like risk. So is this a risky study, you know? But I still want to know whether it's going to be conducted ethically. And you know, that is the question that most people don't actually address. Or indeed, is the research ethical? And there are different ways of looking at that. But will you get there by looking at all that paperwork? So again, perhaps bit of a parody, but it, you know, I'm sure some of the listeners will have had this experience. So your letter or email comes back from the ethics committee, and often or not with a list of corrections to be made, and often or not, I've seen this fairly frequently with your information sheet duly corrected, with the grammar sorted out. And various comments and you've forgotten to say that they can withdraw at any time. There's a whole language around it. You know, you can withdraw at any time. Everything you tell us will be treated in confidence. All of these are not true, because there will always be a point in research when the participant cannot withdraw. Can't withdraw once it's published, obviously. And obviously an interview, for example, is not confidential because you're collecting data. You need those data for the research. The research just won't happen. If you say, well, that was very nice, you told me all of that. I'm going to forget it all now. So you can see it's almost like a performance, a ritual researchers which is not really set up for the benefit of researchers, and I'm not even sure that it's set up for the benefit of participants. But I can see you nodding, and you're obviously familiar with that system. I've already tried to indoctrinate Suffolk to say, don't go down that road. But, you know, I'll stick with it just a little bit longer so that you can see some of the issues. The templates, I'm always getting frustrated by these templates. So you find they all open up in much the same way. You are being invited to join a research project, you know, speak to others if you like. You know, it's all of that language. There is nothing to address a person. There is nothing humane about it. I've seen loads and loads of examples. The one I usually use in the training, which I think is really interesting, is I looked at an information sheet for patients who had just been admitted to hospital with COVID, an acute diagnosis of COVID. And this was obviously in the earlier days of the pandemic, seriously ill people. And really important to get them involved in research projects really quickly. There were various projects around, some involved trying different treatments, some involved effectively immunological type studies and so on, excuse me, but really important. So you're a person that's just been admitted to hospital with COVID. Here's your information sheet, or perhaps on an iPad so you don't have to touch it. You are being invited to a research project. Well, how does that work? You know, here is somebody acutely distressed. And, you know, by the time I've made a few suggestions, well, how about starting with, we are really sorry to hear that you've been admitted to hospital with COVID. You must be incredibly worried, and so must your family. We know very little about COVID, and the only way we're going to find out is research. This is where you could help us. I think, you know, that's so different, and yet it's commonsensical. So why do people carry on, you are being invited to a research project? Because they're not engaging with human beings. And they're probably not even pausing for thought to reflect from their own perspective. And there are numerous other examples. I've been working with some researchers recently on people with pretty serious depression. And worthwhile research, where you don't start off like that. You say, I'm so sorry to hear that you've got depression or whatever. Engage with the person.
It's almost that attempt to be so objective and that objective observer as a researcher that you're forgetting that you are in fact a person, they are a person. You can have a conversation that's not participant researcher.
Exactly. And I mean, obviously, I mean, what you've said there is actually important, because some research, it obviously has to be completely objective. So if you're looking at the STEM type areas, if you've got a clinical trial with hundreds of people in it, you can still do your best to engage. But, you know, essentially the researcher has to stand back and not put too much of themselves in it, and probably not even be too compassionate, because it would then be very difficult to continue to be objective. So in some STEM areas, that model might still make some sense. But it still doesn't really take you away from the idea of treating people with compassion and so on. So the bottom line is that perhaps we should begin to think less about the research as an act and more about the researcher as a moral agent, and less about research ethics review as a one-off event, and more thinking about research ethics as a life lived. I hope the most researchers don't walk away from the ethics committee or don't look at their letter and think, well, that's it, I just do it now. One would hope that they would continue to conduct their research ethically. But it is that particular focus that's really important. I referred to STEM just now. Well, obviously, I don't want to make some sort of dichotomy between STEM subjects and arts, humanities, social sciences, but the latter do provide, they provide much more of a forum for conducting research in different ways. So we were talking about objectivity earlier. In the arts and humanities, there is room, much more room, to conduct research with participants rather than on participants. And I think the standard approach to ethics review doesn't really encourage that. What we should be doing is saying, you know, in what ways are you engaging with your participants? You can't do that if you're running a clinical trial. I can understand that. But you can if you're doing an ethnographic study, or if you've deliberately structured your research. Something like participatory action research, where my dream has always been to see a study where nobody can work out quite who's gaining consent from whom. Now, and that's not crazy, is it? Because, now, and some of the some of the best research is likely to be just like that. I don't mean, you know, like the currently popular PPI. Oh, we must have participant involvement, public and participant involvement, because that just seems to be another ritual. So we find a group of tame people to look at our information sheet and tell us, to put it in better English. But, you know, when you get those group of tame people, they never come back and say, oh, it just reads awfully. You are being invited to join. You know, I've never come across a PPI group who just says, well, why can't you, you know, write to people as people, you know, and explain what you're about and so on. So, you know, although now it's, well, in the NHS, it's pretty well a requirement. I still don't see much evidence of human engagement anywhere. So I suppose what I'm looking at is something which is more humane, more compassionate, ongoing, a life lived, not just a one-off event. And I mean, after all, good research actually does require good researchers. And I'm playing with the word good a bit there, because you can use good research to describe the methodology and the design of the research and so on. And its statistical calculations and all of those sorts of things, you know, that's good research. But what about the good researcher? So turning more to a virtue ethics approach, what I'm looking at is more focus on the researcher and what they bring to the research and how they can bring it. And it's much easier in arts and humanities. That seems obvious. So I'm all for eclectic approaches everywhere. I don't think everybody should throw everything away. And I don't think everybody should throw all of their templates away either. They have their place. But they certainly need a different approach. So if you turn instead attention to the researcher, one of the things that I always want to say to ethics committees is, look, the way you go about ethics review should start at least from a position of trusting the researcher. Why do you sit down with your pile of papers and look for the problems? Because, you know, that's what all too many do. Why don't you actually start off with thinking about, but, you know, there are researchers and people too. Sometimes I do this frequently in the NHS Ethics Committee that I chair. The committee, if left to their own devices, will pore over the information sheet forever. And then I come back and say, hang on, you know, that is not the only vehicle of information which will inform a participant in the process of seeking their consent. You know, how many researchers are going to come along, plonk a long, complicated information sheet in front of a person and walk away? Well, if they are, they're not good researchers, and there I'm using good in a different way. They're certainly not good researchers. But the truth, of course, is that I think it's very rare to find a deliberately constructed unethical research. Lots of, you know, researchers might not be perfect, but they don't set out to break the rules. So most researchers are at least going to go in there and communicate with people. So I'm forever saying, look, yeah, okay, the information sheet's important and all the rest of it. It's a nice thing that the participants can take away and look at when they're very bored and are wondering about the detail. But what they will listen to is when the researcher speaks to them, when the researcher explains things to them. And, you know, it's that sort of thing that the ethics committee should be thinking about much more. What is this researcher like? And notice how I'm twisting it now more towards the researcher, less towards the documents. And then thinking, you know, is this researcher going to conduct their research ethically? And that is really important when you're looking at situations sometimes with some anthropological research where you have local researchers because you need them for language purposes and things like that. And you want them to do the job. So if you look at studies like that, where does the ethics lie? Well, it lies in training those people to, you know, conduct their research ethically. So what we're doing then is looking increasingly at, here's my interest in virtue ethics, at the virtues that the researcher has and the ability of the ethics committee to trust the researcher. Lots of qualitative research has to be done this way. You know, some of the best projects where you see things like, you know, often not a piece of anthropological research or sometimes ethnography, the researcher comes to the committee or sends the documents to the committee. No, I can't tell you what the questionnaire or the interview schedule is because I'm going to create that with the participants. And we're going to move on this. You know, why wouldn't that be grasped? And why wouldn't the ethics committee say, oh, this is good, this is real? You know, instead, they say, well, you know, we can't give you what they call an approval now because we can't see your questionnaire. You'll have to come back with a substantial amendment. And, no, why can't we just embrace the process and the people? And, you know, if the ethics committee can move in that direction, they might be asking, well, how are the researchers trained? What qualities are you seeking in the researchers? You know, and those sorts of questions then become really important.
It's really interesting what you're saying there about that process, and particularly around participatory action research and actually working with the participants. Because I think a lot, it's not just ethics committees, it's funding bodies as well.
Yeah, you're quite right. Just about all of the organisation play the same game, go through the same rituals. I have to say there are some rather more adventurous funding bodies. But, you know, if you do standard NHS research, you basically only get the funds for each individual if you can produce the consent form that they signed. So that's a bit constraining, just to say the least. But often or not, in those sorts of areas of research, they are more likely to be more STEM. And I can understand needing some evidence that these people really were recruited. Because we have to remember, it's more an issue of integrity than ethics, but medical research has got a pretty dark history and still has a pretty dark one in terms of breaches of integrity. And that's an easy check. Though I think some people have been caught falsifying consent forms, but never mind. But that, you know, a different approach or different issue altogether. When I talk to an ethics committee, I say, look, what are you looking for if it's not compliance checking? What should you be looking for? What is the big thing? Well, you start with trusting the researcher, but then the next thing to look for is the degree to which they respect the participants. Now, I mean, the completed template PIS that I talked about, I don't see that shows much in the way of respect. You know, in fact, it's going to drive the participant mad because they've got so much to read. And it really almost, it does objectify them. So, you know, they're the participant. Your job is to read this long piece of paper and to sign this form. You know, I'm the researcher. You know, and so, you know, there isn't any, or there's only very limited scope for co-production and co-research. And actually, some of the best research is co-produced. There's no doubt about it. So I always say, look at the paperwork, because that's all you've got. And that's, you know, in most cases, that's all you will have. The NHS, excuse me, is privileged because, thanks to the pandemic, and I hesitate to say that, we now see all researchers because it's so easy for them to appear virtually at an ethics committee meeting. In the past, it was a bit hit and miss. It just depended on where they were based. So we are really seeing people now, which does give that opportunity to think about those issues of trusting them and then looking for evidence of respect for participants. And it's simple things like that changed introduction that I talked about, you know, the ubiquitous introductory paragraph. It's simple things like you can see a lot from the paperwork. You know, they've produced, I know, an information sheet in 0.10 font or something. Well, how on earth is anybody going to read that? You look through it and there isn't a thank you through the whole thing. You know, now that to me matters. That is an ethical issue. And yet all too often, that's exactly what you'll find. Other things like, not making it easy for people to engage before consenting, and engage in a meaningful way. Let's have a discussion about this. You know, you don't just have to read this or hear the blurb that I'm going to give you. So the focus, as I hope I'm taking it, is more and more saying, let's look at the researcher and let's look at what virtues the ethics committee is looking for. And think about focusing on those virtues. Now, I've actually been involved in virtue ethics about 10 years specifically with research, but my first degree is philosophy, and virtue ethics basically comes from Aristotle. And there's not much to beat Aristotle, actually, when you look at it. I'm not about to give a long lecture, but simple enough. Have a look at human behaviour, look at various dispositions, and think about vices. So having too much of something or not enough of something. So if you take a simple example like courage, which is obviously the virtue, if you've got too much of it, you're going to be pretty reckless. If you've got too little of it, you're going to be pretty timid. Sitting somewhere in the middle is the virtue of courage. A simple enough system. It gets complicated when you start looking and saying why should people pursue virtues and so on, where it's broadly so that they can flourish as human beings. That's what it's really about. But you can take this and put it into a research ethics framework. And here I'm drawing largely on the work of Bruce McFarlane, who I had the privilege of working with for a while. And what he did was to say, well, let's look at research. Let's look at the process that a researcher will go through. So you start off with beginning to plan things. You think about organising things. You think about negotiating various stages, because there's always a lot of negotiation in research. You think about gathering data and so on. And what he did was suggested that you needed a particular virtue in each of those phases. Now, the more important thing is that he refers very strongly to lived out virtues. So what we're keen on finding out is whether researchers are not only going to have at least elements of those virtues to start with, but actually through their lived experience of being a researcher, actually become more virtuous. That's how it works. I mean, nobody was arguing that anybody's born virtuous. You have to work at it. And there's all sorts of different ways of working at it. But that then brings into research, which says probably the most important activity for researchers is reflection. Actually stopping every now and again, looking at what's going on, are we getting this right? Can we improve it? That is obviously going to lead to more ethical research. Long past the point when they've forgotten about the paperwork going to the ethics committee, because they're out there doing it. It still happens in STEM research as well. A lot of the work I'm doing at the moment is ethics review of COVID vaccine research. And, you know, actually the sands are shifting all the time, and there are brilliant researchers involved in the vaccine research. We don't hear enough from them. But they're constantly thinking of things like, well, you know, are these participants going to be anxious because, things like that they've heard about side effects and other adverse events and things like that. You know, what can we do to communicate with them better? You know, how can we get, you know, and we're talking about thousands of people involved there, obviously. So you know, they're exhibiting those virtues, even in a hard science subject or hard science piece of research. If I follow Bruce McFarlane's list of virtues, he advocates courage in researchers, and I'll come back to each of these. Respect, obviously, resoluteness, sincerity, humility, and probably above all, reflexivity. So if all researchers had those virtues, or at least strived to develop them, then we might see ethical research going on, lived out, rather than being this weird event. I'll just pick out one or two of those virtues and you'll be able to see. At the moment, research is, there's a lot of evidence of growing amounts of research, which is less and less challenging, less and less edgy. You know, I need to get something published because the ref's coming up. but you know, it's not that exciting. When actually we need groundbreaking research. So you need courageous researchers to do that. And all too often, you know, they're replicating stuff and things like that. It really isn't, you know, anything terribly exciting. You know, I've seen really exciting things like, well, let's run a clinical trial, but instead of putting people on a drug, let's take them off their drugs. And you start to see things like that. You think, now that is pressing things a bit. You know, that is much more exciting. You know, so courage, I think, is really important. Respectfulness, often or not shown in the simplest of ways, but so important. It makes sense to do that. Resoluteness, so it extends from that courageous research to say, is this a researcher who is going to, I don't know, triangulate? Let's use some scientific terms. Who is, can be used in qualitative research as well, but is really determined to find an answer. Not setting out to find the answer they were hoping to find. Same with sincerity. You know, are they doing this with some passion? You know, which I think is really important, rather than, you know, well, I've won this bid for, you know, and I'm now going to deliver the goods. Are they really sincere? You know, and humility, I just think that's really important. But at the same time, to be bold, and, you know, again, I wish I saw more applications where the researcher said, this piece of research is so important that it would be unethical if it wasn't conducted. And I've seen plenty of research that fits that description, but, you know, instead, nearly all applications to ethics committees have got this weird apologetic tone. so you can see how, you know, looking at the people instead of the documents, obviously, well, to me, it really is a no-brainer. And if you're eclectic, because I'm not suggesting that we should only have virtue ethics in research. I think there's room for it in a very eclectic way. So, you know, we can still keep the good elements of useful elements of compliance and risk assessment and so on. But are we missing probably the bit that matters even mostly, which is the humanity and the compassion? I have actually written back to researchers following an ethics review in some really very interesting ways, because if the ethics committee takes a virtue approach, you can write back and you say, thank you for this courageous piece of research. This is obviously groundbreaking. Yeah, or, you know, you're obviously going to be running some risks, but these risks have been carefully mitigated. You know, and then I carry on with the letter, and the respect that you're showing for participants is quite incredible, as evidenced in what you've done. Now, if I carried on down the list, you could see that there'll be some very shocked researchers. Well, I've never had feedback like that from an ethics committee before. But actually, what they've had is feedback on the ethics of what they're doing. But equally, and I've written this before as well, this is a very timid piece of research. You're really only replicating something that's already happened before. You are really quite disrespectful to your participants because you're using language like this or language like that. Well, you know, you're getting some feedback on ethics then, aren't you? Compare that with, you know, there are numerous typographical errors in your participant information sheet, which is what they've come to know and love.
You're absolutely right. The feedback that we give researchers is normally very much about the box ticking, about getting, you know, you've got all of these things, you've got to make sure that they are spelled correctly, that you've got the contact information correctly, that you're able to tick those boxes. But we're not really supporting our researchers in becoming better, good, morally, researchers. It's mostly about, can you complete the paperwork? And I think that's really important, particularly given that we seem to be training so many researchers, which is great, good quality research. More research happening is good for society, for global citizenship. But we need to make sure we're getting that right. We're not just churning it out. And as I said before, you know, you tend to find that funding bodies have a similar box tick exercise. That, you know, they have criteria that they're grading against, and then you've got ethics committees, and then you've got to get past probationary boards, particularly for doctoral students.
Yeah, yeah.
The ethics training that we give is not necessarily around these virtues. The ethics training we're giving to researchers when they're coming up through their doctoral research and when they're entering new organisations, new research institutions, is more about how to get through the process here, rather than these are the values that we hold as an organisation, these are the values we want to see you demonstrate in your research.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I think if we made a better job of training researchers, then we could do much less ethics review.
Absolutely.
Because we would be confident of, you know, sending people out into the field, whatever the discipline, and we'd be much more confident they would be conducting their research ethically. But, you know, the whole thing has become a huge machine, which I understand, you know, there's lots of money involved and so on. And there are lots of boxes that do have to be ticked. And, you know, I understand all of that. But my concern is that we're losing the most fundamental issues, you know, in going through the processes of ticking the boxes, and that's awful. You know, I mean, if you say to a doctoral student, that's all very well, you know, this is how you get all the boxes ticked, this is how you get it through. When you actually meet with people, how are you going to behave? You know, and have you thought about relationships with participants? You know, I mean, because there is always this thing about some or other, you have to keep participants at arm's length in order to go back to what somebody said earlier, to being objective. But actually, particularly in the humanities and social sciences, the last thing you want to do is to keep the participant at arm's length. You want a relationship with them. And then you have to negotiate, at least in your own head, well, say that relationship continues as a friendship. Is that okay? I mean, researchers need to ask questions like that. And, you know, there's plenty of examples more in the social sciences where participants do indeed, you know, there's continuing relationships. And actually, that's incredibly worthwhile because, you know, I've come across loads of examples where you find a participant might phone a researcher sometime after, let's say, an interview and say, do you know, since that interview, I've just remembered bloody, bloody, blah. Well, you're not going to get that if you've kept them at arm's length or you know, at a distance. So the research gets richer as a result of, you know, managed but appropriate relationships. You know, there's a lot more to look forward to that way, and much more in terms of rich outcomes. You know, it's so I think that this is the big issue: is we need better training, and we need researchers to think much more about how they're actually going to conduct themselves on the in the field, what virtues that are driving their research. And you know, and then obviously there's a better product all round and all benefit. You know, it's really important to do that. You know, it's again, this is sort of loosely related to the vaccine research. I have to keep treading cautiously because it's a lot of it is appropriately confidential. But anyway, you know, you've got a group of participants that have been in a study for approaching a year, and really you'd like to keep them in a bit longer to do some immunology studies. So you can actually either go through the standard process and get all of the right forms together and all the rest of it, or you could write to them and say, thank you so much for what you've already done. This is how it's benefited. You could give a bit of feedback and you say, this is what we've learned in society and your contribution has helped to where we are now, you know, with pretty good vaccines. And then in that letter, can you hang on in here for another year? And I suggested using that language. Well, why wouldn't you? You know, instead of you are being invited to a follow-on study, you know, and actually, the more you engage with people, the more cooperation you get. I mean, if I had a letter like that, I'd think, oh, I can hang on in there for another year. It's not too much of my life consumed with this. And I'm very clear about what they're asking me to do. You know, it's not all been dressed up in scientific language. You know, we want a little bit more blood from you. You know, why can't we use language like that? As for me, it's far more respectful.
It's about talking to people in a relatable way, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, talking to people about a study, taking more work, like blood work from them, you know, taking something from them.
Yeah, yeah.
You're asking something quite personal. You're quite intimate. You need to be able to communicate that.
Yeah.
As you say, respectfully, kindly, in a way that they appreciate, understand. Can relate to rather than in a way that the scientific community normally relates to.
Exactly. Because it's then meaningful, isn't it? You know, and people can see that they are making a valuable contribution. You know, and sometimes that's quite hard if you're just an individual. It's not obvious what you're doing. But, you know, it's you know, I think anybody is much more prepared to participate in research if they can feel as though there are some wider benefits, and they're quite happy in lots of cases if you say, this won't benefit you at all. And again, I always look for clear language like that. If there are no benefits, then you just write and say this would be of no value to you at all. We're asking you to give up your time and so on, but this is our goal. This is what we're trying to do, and you would be contributing to that. But personally, you might have to run a few risks. And get nothing back in return, but other than the knowledge, and this is, you know, this is where I think that virtue ethics approach spins out more widely. We're not getting enough, I would say more broadly, social sort of altruism, where people, you know, they're always looking to see maybe how much they're going to be paid and things like that. That's okay in a first-in-man trial drug. You know, I can understand that because there's definitely no benefits. They are running risk. They will be giving up a lot of their time. They might as well be paid for it. I don't have a problem with that. But, you know, research needs to be more publicly owned, I think. And that's never has that been more important than now. because, you know, some very funny ideas out there from Joe Public about the vaccines and about COVID generally and so on. Not enough sensible messaging so that people can see the roles they're playing.
And that comes back to a whole other conversation, which I really we really shouldn't be get into because we won't have time, but about, you know, research being seen as done to people by experts, by boffins, by, you know, random researchers who sit in this elite castle and, you know, dabble in the real world but aren't part of it. And I think that's that separation just isn't helpful in any way, particularly as you say at the moment. But taking this more virtual ethics approach can really help mitigate some of those them us perceptions that research isn't for everyone.
Exactly. And or actually round the other way, research is for everyone. If I come in from a personal angle, and this is not got anything to do with what I'm immediately engaged in, but you know, I'm just horrified in the UK how damn selfish we are. You know, we should be doing everything we can to get vaccines out via COVAX as widely as possible, rather than, and I will be open here, squeezing something into a five-year-old, which will be of dubious benefit and might even be a risk. What's being lost is the whole idea, and COVID really illustrates this well, is that it's a global issue. And, you know, we're never going to get there until we start thinking about other people and we think about how to get those vaccines more widely distributed. I suppose there may be some commercial benefit, but at the same time acknowledging that AstraZeneca are doing their best to bung this out at cost, you know, and the cost must be pretty huge. But nevertheless, you know, not even a profit. So we should be, I don't know, pulling together much more with a society that values virtue rather more. When you talk about virtues, it's what seems to me to have disappeared, and this I'm straying into social ethics now, is the good old fashioned virtues. You know, if we want to live together successfully, you know, what about love? What about solidarity? What about respect for each other? You know, and a lot of those old-fashioned values have been lost in this sea of, you know, various ethics codes for research and things like that, instead of, you know, trying to engage with humanity. I'll stop, because otherwise I'm going to wander off too far.
David, thank you very much. It's been a really interesting conversation. It's been fantastic to hear about your approach to ethics and actually how you feel we can make ethics better. Yeah. That's not even like research better using good ethics. Exactly. So I really appreciate the conversation. Thank you.
Most welcome.